All right, I want to welcome everyone to the Building Fires podcast. I'm Corey McCain, your co-host, CEO of WeStrive.
I'm Farhad Jamayan, the CEO of Canna.
Boom. So every week we interview some of the coolest entrepreneurs on the planet. They've had billion-dollar exits, absolutely killing it, and we figure out how they did it, why they did it, and we try and get tips for everyone on how to really grow a company.
Absolutely. Totally unscripted, casual conversations where we get to, you know, that real deep dive view of exactly what went down, but a lot of fun, really great. Tune in.
Building fires.
Text, I'm ready to go down, man. I'm ready to, you made some shepherd's pie today. It's fire. I'm already excited.
Yeah, I can smell it. I think there's a vent below my floor.
Yeah, that comes right through the vents. It hits the rooms.
Yeah. I know when he's cooking. Anyways, back to the podcast. So we interviewed Vincent Dorion this week, and I had a smile on my face the whole time. This is actually my best friend, Tucker Harmon, his girlfriend, Teresa. This is her dad. Tucker always told me her dad had like some really cool startup story, and he did a really bad job of like lowballing it because he was part of a four-man founding team for Eco ATM. They built up thousands of kiosks to return your to recycle and refurbish phones and get paid for it, and then they sold for $350 million about 8 years ago. So Farhaj, tell them how it was.
Yeah, I really loved enjoying it, like just listening to his story, because it was like, yeah, you know, we launched our first kiosk, and it was hilarious due to the fact that nobody would accept their kiosk, and they had to go all the way to Place to take their first pilot, but instantly found product market fit. And just a lot of the cool things that he did, I think is very similar to the trajectory of startups today. But one of the most impressive things, I guess, is just like the conviction that their team and the founder had to exactly where they wanted to end up. And also, fun fact, we didn't get to cover this in the episode, but as of today, they've helped get 25 million devices refurbished and recycled.
Wow. Back in the market. Where'd you find that number at?
It was on the homepage. I scrolled down a little bit and I found it, but I was just like, wow, that's insane. And they significantly changed the delta from 2%, which he talked about, to a lot higher number. So incredible company, incredible mission. Amazing, super chill, yet laid back and awesome story. I think y'all will enjoy listening to this one.
Boom. This is Vincent Dorion with Eco ATM.
Yeah, and I kind of wanted to ask you, like, how did all this get started? Like, and so what was your role at the company as well?
I had different roles. I mean, it was my final role was director of operations. I think when I started, it was some sort of executive VP because there was four of us. But it started. I've been an engineer for like 20 years and I've worked for different companies, but I spent a lot of time working for Nokia mobile phone. I spent about 15 years there. And then I went and joined a startup called NextWave, which didn't go so well. And it went belly up at the big crash in 2008. And after that, there was a bunch of us that were sort of looking for something to do. I was unemployed for quite a few months. And then a mutual friend, a guy called Michael Labrisi, introduced me to Mark Bowles, who was the CEO of Eco ATM. And when we met, he actually wanted to arrange a meeting with Nokia. And Michael knew that I had contacts there. So I set up a meeting for Mark to go into Nokia and meet their executives. And I think, you know, we had quite a lot of senior management in San Diego at the time who were visiting from Finland. So Mark and I went in to meet with them. And Mark pitched the idea to them and they didn't like it at all. Because, you know,
they didn't like the Eco ATM idea.
No, they didn't like it because they saw it as a threat to them and taking away business, you know, because they sell new phones. The idea behind Eco ATM is, of course, that a customer will sell their old phone through the kiosk. And, you know, they didn't like the idea. But I guess during the meeting, you know, Mark and I got on pretty well. We were talking, you know, doing the pitch, and I started sort of helping him. I think it, you know, the meeting was enjoyable. I think there was like, you know, we had a good rapport. And so after that meeting, Mark asked me, would I be interested in joining EcoATM? And of course I wasn't doing anything at the time. So I said, yeah, of course. And, then we started, and, when we started, we just had meetings in Mark's kitchen. We didn't have offices or anything. And,
wow.
And there was like, I think I was number four.
The rest is history.
Yeah, the rest is history. I mean, it took probably 5 years to get it to the point where I knew it was going to be successful. But, you know, we had a very good exit. We were bought by Outerwall for $350 million. Which I think at the time was one of the highest sort of startup exits in San Diego.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, especially, I mean, in the U.S. alone, that's definitely in the top. But, I mean, yeah, San Diego, it's probably at least number one. Wait, when you joined EcoATM, was there any kiosks yet, or was it just still an idea?
No, it was an idea, but Mark... So the first thing that we needed to do was prove the concept. So Mark had been working with local manufacturer, and we had like a big kiosk, which we called Bessie, but it wasn't automated at all. It had like a computer screen on it, and you were able to put in the make of your phone and look up, and it would tell you the price of the phone. And then, you know, the customer could decide did they want it or not. So we were trying, that was how we started. And then we were trying to find a location where we could put the kiosk. It's not an automated kiosk, so somebody would have to stand by it. And we ended up going to Omaha, Nebraska. I think it was Nebraska Furniture Store to do a trial.
Wow.
And we stayed there a month.
People were buying phones in the furniture store?
Yeah. It was the only place that would take us.
Wow.
That's brilliant.
That's incredible.
So it was Warren Buffett owned it. You know, it was part of his sort of empire. But yeah, it was one of the only places that would agree for us to do a four-week trial. And Mark, you know, contacted the local press and things like that and told them we were coming. And I think there was six of us at that time. So we all, you know, took shifts doing week on, week off sort of thing. And so we were there a month, and I think we collected over 3,000 phones. And
wow.
On the first day that I went to do it, Mark, the press release came, and I went down, and there was a line probably about 50 people waiting to use the kiosk.
Jeez.
And, you know, they all had these piles of a lot of junk, you know, it was a lot of old phones. And, you know, it was sort of crazy. It was like, you know, we were just so busy pricing people's phones and, you know, giving them money. So we had a bag of cash with us, and we would pay for these phones. And
wow.
So that proved the concept for, you know, for investors, that this would actually work. And so we took those results, and then we started going to investor pitches, you know, and sort of showing them what we had done and that this was, you know, possible, and, you know, explained that it would be a fully automated kiosk. There would be nobody there, no attendants. And our goal was to, you know, ramp up to thousands of kiosks throughout the country. I think today there's between 2,000 and 3,000 kiosks in the U.S. And they have actually started working in Europe now, I think in Germany and UK as well.
Well, one thing I wanted to ask, I mean, that's incredible. So when you first started, like, what was the, like, what are you getting out of the cell phones? Do you sell the parts, or like, is it an environmental thing? Or what is the benefit for your company to do this?
Oh, so there's two parts of it. I mean, we sort of marketed ourselves as a green company, And, you know, whenever Mark first started the company, it was because there was an article from Nokia Mobile Phones, and they were talking about reuse of phones. And they were saying, you know, that only 2-3% of the phones that they produced, which was billions of them, were reused. So that was where he got the idea that, you know, there must be a secondhand market. And he started doing research into it. And there is a big secondhand market. So there's two different sides of it. So you can take old phones and get the parts out of them and get the precious metals and things like that. That's not the most lucrative. The most lucrative part is to buy like a 2-year-old iPhone that still works and buy that and then sell it to a refurbisher, and then they resell it to other markets like in India or South America, different places.
Wow. So y'all became like the collection agency.
Yeah, we were the collection agencies, and then we would sell it on to the refurbishers. And I think at the moment, EcoATM is also doing the refurbishing part as well. But one of the reasons that it worked well in the US was because the model at the time, I'm not sure it's the same today, but the carriers would subsidize your phone. So if you went in to get a new phone, you would maybe get an iPhone and they would charge you $100 or something like that. But in actual fact, that phone was costing $600. So if it was 2 years old and people come to sell it and we're offering them $80, they think that's, you know, oh, this is really good. But, you know, we would then be able to sell it for $200 or whatever it happens to be. So there was, you know, a good margin on the products.
Well, one question I have, I feel like there's so many different types of cell phones. So, I mean, what were your projections like? Did you have like a spreadsheet laid out and then like hundreds of different cell phones and the margins on each one you could sell it for? Or like, how did you guys even predict all that stuff?
Yeah, I mean, that wasn't my side of the what I was doing. I was sort of working on the engineer and getting the kiosk to work and then on the operation side. But yeah, we had spreadsheets. I mean, there is a market for secondhand phones. So, you know, there were buyers for the phones. And actually, there were a lot of buyers. So the way that it worked was that we would tell the buyers what we had, and they would tell us what they were going to give us. And then, you know, we would be able to sell it to the highest bidder. So there was actually competition for people wanting to buy our phones. And they had the spreadsheets, I guess, is what was the point of how much they wanted, you know, what phones they wanted and how much they would actually pay for them. And a lot of times, you know, they would want to do a batch. So they would maybe want 200 or 500 of a certain type of phone, and they would be prepared to pay a premium for that. So we would know that, and then that would be priced into the kiosk, you know, that, okay, we want these phones to offer a little bit more than we had been or something like that. So that was the model for the pricing.
And then with you as the engineer, are you a software engineer or like a mechanical engineer? Like, what was your specific role when it comes to the kiosk?
My background is in electronics, actually in application specific integrated circuit design, but you know, it's all sort of engineering at the end of the day, you know, so it's like, I was helping on the vision stuff, you know, because we had a visual system which would recognize the phones via camera. And then the mechanical parts.
Super cool.
The robotic parts, sort of, you know, all of the different things. So, I mean, I didn't do the, I managed the subcontractors and stuff like that to get certain things done.
I mean, that sounds like an overwhelming project. I can't imagine. I mean, I understand you're an awesome engineer, but I can't imagine, you know, putting together an entire kiosk and then having like a software element, having a brand new mechanical element, having it scan. I mean, so like when you from idea to actual production, like how long did it take you guys to actually build out a workable, functional kiosk that can operate on its own?
So I think it was probably about 3 years it took. But we hired a lot of good people. Like I said, you know, I started in the engineering, but we actually hired a VP of engineering, John Bean, because he had had a lot of kiosk experience, not in that particular area in the medical field, but you know, I think the reason that it worked so well was because of the team. And actually, it sort of reminds me, when I first met Mark, he was the CEO of the company, and he said to me, I'm not going to be the CEO forever. You know, I'm going to swap at some point. And I remember at the time, yeah, I thought he was joking me, you know, because my mindset at the time was, okay, if you're the CEO, it's your company, you're not going to sort of give up the reins. But he sort of had the big picture, and he knew what he wanted. You know, he wanted an exit. He knew that his skill sets, well, he thought that. I didn't think that. But, you know, he wanted to bring somebody else in, a CEO. And at a certain point, that is what he did. He brought in Tom Tully, a CEO of the company, and he stepped back to chief marketing officer, just because, you know, in his mind, Tom had better skill sets for negotiating and stuff like that, which, I mean, it worked out well. Tom, you know, did a great job.
I love that. You know, what it sounds like is, like, very early on, y'all found a semblance of product market fit. You know, people wanted to sell their phones as fast as possible. Y'all were able to acquire it, then resell it to, you know, markets that were refurbishing it and distributing to other industries. Like, how did that affect scaling your company? Because I'm assuming after you put, you know, your first kiosk and your second kiosk and the third kiosk, like, both the supply and demand side of, like, your company were blowing up. So did you guys, like, increase headcount really fast? Did you start to see, like, expansions into new markets and new, you know, malls and new territories really quickly? And, you know, how was that experience?
Yeah, I mean, the growth was phenomenal. And, you know, I think one of the things that sort of helped that was we actually had a subcontracting company that we were working with. And the initial one, it wasn't working very well. I won't say who they are, but it just wasn't working. They weren't going to scale. But then it just so happened that one day I had a visit from a guy, Mike Morrison, from a company called D&K Engineering in San Diego. And he explained what they were doing. And, you know, they were actually ex-HP guys, printer guys. And awesome. So after I met with them, I told Tom, you know, these are the guys we need to go to. You know, yeah, they have all the skill sets that we need. And so that's where we went. And at the end, I think we were producing like 50. Well, it actually depended on the demand, but we could actually get maybe like 50 kiosks built in a week.
Wow.
So, and those kiosks, you know, were probably 15 to 20,000 each. So there was a lot of capex in the company, but they paid off. The kiosks were paid off reasonably quickly because the margins were good, you know, at the time.
Absolutely. And I bet, like, you know, y'all's brand equity was really high and people were really excited about what you were doing. You know, at any point, especially, you know, since word started to spread around and people saw how lucrative this opportunity was, were y'all, like, kind of, you know, suspect of some competitors popping up who are going to go raise money from alternative capital investors to come in and, you know, try to compete head on with y'all? Or were you super kind of bullish on your thesis and how, you know, you were building early traction and translating it into a huge company?
So a couple of stories on that one. So, I mean, IP was a big part of it. So, you know, we spent time getting patents in place for that very reason, to sort of protect our space a little bit. But also, there was a competitor, a company called Gazelle, but they did an online model where you could send your old phones in to them and they would send you money. The problem with their model was, though, that they had to spend most of their profits and stuff on marketing, whereas for EcoATM, we didn't spend hardly anything on marketing at all, because it was all word of mouth.
Because the kiosk was your marketing?
Yeah, you had that physical location, yeah.
We had a physical location. People would see the kiosk. They would use it, maybe after seeing it for 4 or 5 times. Then they would tell their friends, you know. So at one point, I was actually installing kiosks in the different malls and stuff like that. And, you know, I was installing one one day, and there was like a group of five people come up to me and said, "Is it working yet?" And I said, "What? How do you even know about this?" And he said, "Oh, our friends told us about it. There's one down in the mall, you know, 20 miles from where we were." So,
wow, that's such a cool feeling as a to go from sitting in a kitchen talking about a startup to you're putting one in and they're already in line, basically waiting to use it. That's insane.
Yeah.
Was that kind of the moment that you realized you guys had made it, or was there a moment before that that you realized?
I think, yeah, it was around about that time that I thought, you know, I think I actually called Mark and told him that story and said, "I think we might have something here." So
that's amazing.
But yeah, that was a big thing. But then the other part of the kiosk was that because we were buying old phones, we were actually subject to secondhand dealer laws. So it's just like a pawn store. So that required us taking IDs from people, like their driver's license. But then we also had to compare the photo on the driver's license to the person that was standing in front of the kiosk. So it meant that we ended up with like a call center of about 30, 40 people that would have to monitor every transaction and make sure that the person that's standing there in front of the camera is actually
unreal.
That's on the license. And then, you know, we would have to, if they were wearing a cap or something like that, we would have to say, "Please take your cap off," you know, stuff like that. And so every transaction was in real time and recorded. And, you know, they also had to provide a fingerprint. So, you know, it was actually, I think that we caught quite a few people trying to fence phones or trying to get rid of stolen phones. And we were
sure
to sort of get that information to the police, you know, if somebody lost their phone and we had it, we could give them information about the transaction and give them photographs of who did it and all the rest of it.
Did people think that the camera on the ATM was like an automated like robot? Or was it obvious that it was an actual person operating on the other end?
They wouldn't have known. And actually, we could have done it automated. I mean, the visual technology is there that you could conceivably do it, you know, by automation. But the actual law requires that it was a physical, that a person like a had human to compare. Being.
Yeah.
Yeah, it had to be a human being. That was what the law said. So that was why we did that. But
that must be such a cool job, just sitting behind a computer screen, looking, verifying people's IDs. You're like a virtual, like, you know, bouncer at a bar or a bartender confirming an ID.
No, I know. I used to sit in on those, you know, in the call center just to, you know, to experience it. And it was pretty cool. It was pretty cool.
Yeah. You guys were like the original Ring basically, but for your own kiosk.
Yeah.
Wait, and so what's the timeline on this? When are the kiosks live? Is this like early 2000s, early 2010s? Like, when is this?
Yeah, 2010, something around that, 2010.
Gotcha. Because I know if we do a quick fast forward to your exit, I know that you guys are in the same corporation relatively with, as far as parent companies go, with Redbox and Coinstar. So was there any affiliation before the exit, or was it kind of a competitor in a way, or like what, is there any relation there at all?
Oh yeah. So from day one, Mark had identified Eiderwall, which is Coinstar, Redbox, as a potential buyer. So when I first met him, he told me what his exit strategy was, which, you know, I think is a good
lesson. Worked? Wow.
It's a good lesson for other startups because, you know, I talk to people sometimes and I say, "What's your exit strategy?" And it's like, "What?" And it's, you know, "Well, we're going to go IPO." And whereas that is not, doesn't happen very often. But, you know, Mark had this exit strategy right from the get-go. And he actually contacted the founder of Coinstar, who no longer worked for the company, and he was a member of the board for EcoATM. So he knew a ton of the people that worked at Eiderwall, and he was on our board. So that was sort of part of the strategy, was to pull, you know, Outer Wall, sort of Coinstar Redbox into the picture.
Super cool. It was like playing chess in 4D. I love that.
Yeah, and it was interesting because I worked at Nokia, and I knew somebody that worked at Brightpoint. Brightpoint are a big sort of distributor of cell phones. They were the biggest in the U.S., I think probably still are. And they were also interested. And so we brought Tom sort of to talk to my friend at Brightpoint, and we were trying to bring them into the tent as well for competition, but Outerwall didn't want them to be involved. So, but that turned out good for us because it helped with valuation. So it was, the strategy was there from day one, I think, as to what we wanted to do. Not my strategy, but Mark's strategy, Mark Gold.
That's amazing. You know, for a lot of the founders who are kind of, you know, have pretty robust engineering backgrounds and want to take a chance on going into like deep tech and hard tech, and especially taking a bet in a hardware startup, I'm curious if you have any advice. You know, they definitely are a lot more capital intensive and higher risk, but you know, what are some key pieces of advice that you'd love to share with our listeners?
I don't know if it's advice, but you know, I know from Mark, you know, I've talked to him about this, and he would say, you know, sort of shoot for the stars, because, you know, he says if you do something like an app or something like that, it sounds simple, but the amount of work that you have to put into that app to get it to the point where it's, you know, a viable company that is probably the same as what we put into doing EcoATM. Obviously, quite a bit more work at the front end with mechanics and all that sort of stuff. But just to make it a viable startup company, doing something like an app, there's so much competition, and it's so hard to market and to get that app to sort of pop up from your competition that he always sort of said, you know, shoot for the stars and do something adventurous.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Farhaj and I can both touch on that. I mean, I personally run an app and a software platform, and then he has a different platform now, but he used to run an app. So we can both vouch on how difficult apps can be. So, I mean, yeah, me personally too, I think people always talk about how hard hardware is, but then at the same time, it's like, you know, you think software is going to be easy, and then all of a sudden you're, you know, on version 40 and you're still trying to grow sales. So, I think both have difficulties. And to your point too, I think with software, it is a little easier. And so you are going to have that competition. So it's going to make sales even more difficult. So, and one thing go ahead.
There certainly weren't any competitors for us. And I don't think there are any still. I mean, you know, we even had the Chinese government coming over to talk to us about, you know, getting chaos and stuff like that. So
spooky.
We didn't see any competition. And I still don't think there are others out there doing it.
And what was the eco-friendly effect? Like did you guys have any sort of like measurables or data on like how good for the planet your company was?
Yeah. Yeah, a lot of stuff. I don't have it at my fingertips, but yeah, if you go onto that website, the ecoatm.com, it sort of shows how many phones have been refurbished, collected, and how many sort of trees that is equivalent to, and, you know, carbon footprint, all of that stuff. So a big pitch was to, you know, to be a green company, and I guess, you know, not to be sort of too, whatever the word is, but I mean, it wasn't just, we did actually want to be a green company because a lot of us had been involved in making electronics and doing cell phones and felt, you know, hey, maybe we should give back a little bit, you know, and help the planet.
Yeah.
So that was part of the thinking behind what we were doing.
And I'm looking at your website now. So, I mean, you guys have a ton of awards. So, I mean, I'm looking at, you know, you won TechCrunch Best Clean Startup of the Year in 2012, San Diego Award for Entrepreneurship, Hottest Companies Award. I mean, so you're winning, you won a Pitch Fest. So, I mean, you're winning a ton of awards. Like, I feel like right when, you know, entrepreneurship is really becoming a thing, like, and I've said this many, many times on our podcast, but like, I think Shark Tank kind of made entrepreneur a word, or like at least a relevant word. And that was around like early 2010s. So like right when you guys were winning all these awards, it's like right at the heat of, you know, the Y Combinators and all that kind of stuff kind of like really come into the picture. So,
yeah.
I mean, that's incredible. I think that's cool that you guys were able to do it while leaving a, you know, a good footprint on the planet too.
Yeah. Well, a couple of things on that. So we were actually asked to go on Shark Tank.
Yes.
But we didn't go.
No way.
We didn't go in the end, but also on all of the awards. So that was part of the strategy. So Mark would, and Mark and others, we would enter into every competition that was going. So
yeah,
all of the competitions. And it's not just to win the competition, obviously, it's to get visibility to investors that go to these shows and TechCrunch and things they got. And actually, the very first one that we entered into was one that Coinstar held, and it was called The Next Big Idea. And it was looking for kiosk ideas for the future. And that was one of the first competitions that we went entered into and won. And of course, that got us visibility into Coinstar as well.
That's a really good, I wrote that down. That's such a good point. Because I always kind of puss out and don't do competitions. I get like, I'm like, I don't know, I don't need to. But I mean, award, like winning it aside, award aside, like just the visibility, like being on their website and being in front of a panel and a group of people, should be obvious to me that that's an amazing, you know, publicity stunt. And I think, not publicity stunt, but like, you know, getting you in the public eye. And Farhaj can actually touch on this more because Farhaj has actually personally won a lot of pitch competitions too. But I mean, yeah, it's incredible for your company for sure.
Yeah, that's like the secret sauce of being an entrepreneur is if you can be everywhere all the time, people just have no idea how you make it happen. And the network effects that come from bumping into people who are in similar vein of an industry that you're in always like unlock new people that you meet, new investors that you get introduced to, and even greater partnership opportunities. So I've always enjoyed pitching.
Yeah, no, that it's for sure. It's very important, you know, and probably people don't think of it like that. You know, they're thinking, nah, I'm too busy for getting into competitions and stuff like that. But it's not about winning the competition. It's about growing your network and meeting investors and sort of, you know, spreading the word.
I love that so much. That's amazing. So at the point you got your exit offer, was this something that you were like, because it sounds like to me, like this whole time, Mark just had this, knew what was happening. Like he was like, this is going to happen next. This is going to happen next. So
the man with the plan.
When you get an offer for $350 million. Yeah. When you get an offer for $350 million, are you shocked or was it just like this was supposed to happen kind of a thing?
I was shocked. I think Mark.
Okay. Fair enough.
Mark was happy. And of course, you know, Tom Tully, who was the person that he brought in as CEO, you know, one of his best skills was negotiation. And I think he was a pretty hard negotiator. So yeah, I think we were all happy with the outcome.
That's incredible. I mean, yeah, set for life. I mean, that's such a cool opportunity. How many employees did you guys have at that point when you had your exit?
It was probably 100, or maybe not as high as 100, but somewhere around that, like 80s, something like that.
That's incredible. And then do you guys still have like involvement in the company at all? Like, are you on the board in any way, or is it kind of like you had the exit and then you kind of, you know, pushed it away?
I'm not sure if Mark is still involved. He might. I don't think any of us are involved. I know that Tom left immediately after the acquisition, and lots of us sort of stayed around for a year or so, you know, as per contract. But then after that, I think Mark may still be involved, but I'm not 100% sure. I know he thinks of it as his baby, so.
Yeah. Well, and I was going to ask you, actually, you just mentioned it for a second, but I'm always really curious on how the exit process works. So, I mean, once you sold the company for all that money, Obviously you're under contract, but like what kinds of things did you have to do as the, you know, the original engineer and, you know, obviously the, I believe you said VP of operations at that point. Mm-hmm. So what things did you have to do for the newcomers coming in to like show them how to operate the company?
Mainly a lot of training and, you know, handed off knowledge, you know, to people that were going to take over. Like for me, one of the big things was I had to get service manuals and things like that written so that we could have a team of service engineers. So, mainly transfer of knowledge was the reason that they always want people to stick around. And not so much on the CEO side, but on the technical and, you know, the people that are actually running the day-to-day stuff.
And I actually love that you mentioned that too, because actually I think Farhaj will talk about this in a sec, but Farhaj was mentioning the other day about kind of making more operations manuals and more like, you know, I don't even remember the word he used, but just kind of in that
living
situation.
Living and dying
so
by
like,
your SOPs.
SOPs, there we go. Yeah, he was just talking about that. So like, you know, when they bring on new employees, you know, they're able to easily, much easier, not easily, but much easierly, I guess is the word I'm going to use, transfer over the duties to the new employees. So, I mean, that's a good point that you guys had to do that post. Is that something that you think if you could go back, you would have kind of done all along? Or, I mean, I guess maybe at that point you don't really care because you already made a ton of money and you were going to exit the company anyways.
I mean, we had started that process. It just became more obvious about what we needed to do. Yeah. You know, with the new guys in charge, you know, they're worried we disappear and, you know, nobody knows anything. So,
yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, Vincent, I guess my last question for you today is going to be, so what are you working on today? You know, we'd love to hear about what you're excited about, what kind of future you're looking towards, and yeah, how maybe, you know, one of our listeners could be a part of that process or support you.
So at the moment, I'm not doing anything. I'm actually just volunteering a lot for Meals on Wheels during this COVID.
Oh, right on. Yeah.
Yeah. So I've been doing that for a few months. I have a couple of startups that I sort of coach and working with. And then I'm sort of nothing solid yet, but I'm interested in a SPAC. So it's a...
Special Purpose Acquisition Vehicles,
so,
right?
I have an ex-colleague that has started a SPAC. And yeah. I think that would be very interesting to do, because it sort of takes out the whole, you know, startup, what's the idea, how are we going to do it, and sort of brings it to the next stage where, you know, it's difficult for them to get the funding. So it's sort of, I'm interested in that, because I think it would be great to sort of find startup companies that are, would be sort of good candidates for a SPAC.
Absolutely.
And to, you know, to do that. So,
yeah, there was a big announcement actually earlier today. Open Door, the company that Keith Robois, who's at Founders Fund, kind of founded, Chamath Patiapla, like Palyaptia at Social Capital, just announced an SPAC that's going to be acquiring Open Door in anticipation of their IPO. So the trend is definitely catching on. And I think there's a lot of massive opportunity there.
And I think the one that I'm talking about would be in the telecoms industry, and the people that are involved in it are sort of, they all have like a lot of good experience and know their stuff. So, you know, it's sort of like bringing a ton of experience to a company and sort of letting them leverage that. You know, obviously they need to give up equity for that, but I think it'll be very lucrative.
Well, Vincent, this was honestly one of the coolest stories I've heard. I had a smile on my face the whole time. I love how it started. Obviously love how it ended. And I'm glad that you're still, you know, involved in the startup space. And, you know, and I think what you mentioned before we started talking is that, you know, you didn't plan on any of this and you didn't plan on being an entrepreneur or being in a startup. And I think that's how we all are. So, like I said, I got my accounting degree. I thought I was going to be doing financial planning or something like that. I don't know what Farhaj was in robotics, I think. So I mean, I don't really know what he was going to do, but this has been incredible. I really appreciate you taking the time and thank you. This was great.
No, thanks. Thanks for asking me. I enjoyed it.
Absolutely. All right, Vincent. Well, you have an awesome day. I appreciate it. And, you know, hopefully I'll, you know, come down to San Diego someday with Tucker and Teresa and meet you in person.
Yeah, that would be great. That'd be great. Thanks very much.
Bye-bye.
Thanks everyone so much for tuning in to the Building Fires podcast.
Yeah, man, we're planning on dropping episodes every Monday, talking to some amazing guests and giving you the content you deserve.
Boom. Farhaj and I are so grateful for you guys for that. I can edit this.
I know.
Farhaj and I are so grateful for all of your support. If you can, please leave 5 stars and a review on your podcast app, whichever one you use. Farhaj and I would definitely appreciate it. I'm trying to get our little podcast SEO up.
Yeah, man. Well, you know, looking forward to seeing you next week, and we're excited to make... Ugh, 1 second. Looking forward to seeing you next week. We got some exciting guests for you.
Boom. Guests for you.
Like guests for you.
You scurvy curs.
Boom. Arr. Boom.